President Obama wants to make body cameras available to police departments across the country. This hour, we hear from an Iowa police force that's been using body cameras for a year. It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to wrap up the week. About a half dozen news items to tackle this hour. A case of alleged wage theft here in the state. The controversy over preserving three 150-year-old cottages in Iowa City. Where did Giving Tuesday come from and why? And we speak with the Iowa author of What Did Jesus Drive? To buckle up for your Friday News Buzz after this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our Friday edition of quick conversations about some news to otherwise during our talk shows in the week. In response to the events in Ferguson and elsewhere in the country, on Monday, President Obama proposed a three-year, $263 million spending package. This is to expand training and increase the use of body-worn cameras for monitoring police officers' interactions with the public. Now, the White House is calling for $75 million over 3 years to be used for 50,000, some 50,000 body cameras made available to police departments across the country. So today, we want to check in with an Iowa police force that has been using the cameras on the job for the past year. Officer Mario Coleman is with the Clive Police Department, Clive, just west of Des Moines. Officer Coleman, welcome to our program.
Hey, how are you doing?
So what made Clive choose to use cameras before most?
I just believe that our chief just wanted to get kind of ahead of the times and use this tool as almost an addition to what we already was using as far as our in-car camera systems. There also was, a Supreme Court case that came out that made police departments, whenever we're conducting interviews of individuals, to have it either visually or audibly recorded. So that was an added addition to help us in those type of cases.
Now, it's been in use for months, a year, I guess. Have there been incidents when that camera footage, that audio, that video was necessary to look back on?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, in every instance. Our policy states that whenever we're in any kind of contact with the public, especially if it's taking a report, a car accident, traffic accident, or any kind of disputes of any sort, we must activate these cameras. Me personally, whenever I take reports or go to people's homes or answer any calls for services, I always activate my camera. Mm-hmm. Usually you may get information that you may not take as far as on your note, that you might look at your video and you go, oh, I missed that. And that might help you with the report writing.
So you refer to your footage, would you say, every shift?
Yeah, every day.
So it just makes work easier.
Exactly. And again, I mean, as we all know that when a story is told to someone, you necessarily do not get all of the facts the way it was told, and you might try to interpret it and write it that way. That way, if you're making a report and you want to take that person's statement exactly the way it was given to you, if it wasn't in writing. Mm-hmm.
So does it surprise you sometimes looking back at footage that it actually happened a different way than you remember it?
Oh, most definitely. But usually I got a pretty good memory, so majority of my footage that I have, in a way, especially if there's an arrest involved, would usually just show the person that was arrested their demeanor, their statements, whatever answers they had to my questions, or any other physical proof, like if they had a fight or altercation, any kind of injuries or marks of any sorts on their person.
So how do you use it? It's a little camera. Where is it placed?
The camera that we have for our department is the V-View. It's from the company V-View. And it's a camera that's it's black in color and it's rubberized, and which I believe helps with being water resistant and also shockproof. The camera is actually I have mine pinned on my chest, as far as between my sweater and my uniform. And when the camera is activated, there's actually a door that you slide down. Once the door is slid down, you actually can see the lens of the camera. And on top of the camera, there'll be a flashing light whenever the camera is activated.
Mm-hmm. And so are there guidelines you've come up with, like, okay, you come to knock on my door, want to ask about whatever. So I open the door. Do you notify me that the camera's in use or not?
No, we do not. But if an individual asks if this conversation has been recorded or is that a camera on your chest, we do tell them yes.
Did it take other officers, you and other officers, some time to get used to this? Is there a breaking in period?
No. Well, I was one of the first officers actually that tested it before the whole department, before the chief purchased, I believe the 7 or 8 cameras that we have, and I enjoyed it. I'm kind of a technology buff, and I just felt that this was just an added extra tool that I guess you can, you know, put on the belt, you know, the utility belt, if you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I enjoy, for example, if I have a case that I need to prepare for, or even just a court case on a traffic citation. Sometimes you might not remember the conversation or remember the interaction that you had with the person that you gave a ticket to. Usually when I get my subpoena, I go to that date, I pull my ticket, and then I actually pull the video so I can remember exactly what happened.
It sounds like you're definitely in favor of it. It sounds like you would see it as a good move by the president to try to get millions of dollars to supply other police departments across the country with these cameras. I know the ACLU has come out in favor of these cameras, so it's a win-win. Is there any downside we should be made aware of?
No, I don't believe it's a downside.
Before we go, I want to see if you had a reaction to the video that everybody's been watching, the news out of New York, Eric Garner video, and the decision by the grand jury not to indict there.
Well, you know, I would like to probably keep my opinion to myself, but that video was real sad to watch.
Isn't it? It's a very difficult video to watch,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. And again, stuff exactly like that video showed. I mean, you're seeing everything, you know, visually, as well as, I mean, the sounds that, you know, was associated with that video is just real sad.
The man who died, Eric Garner, I can't breathe, repeated again and again.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much for telling us a little bit about these body-worn cameras. The president is proposing to make $75 million available over 3 years to police departments around the country. Officer Mario Coleman is with the Clive Police Department, and they've been using body cameras for a year. Thank you very much, Officer Coleman.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
Glad you're aboard for our Friday News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now on to a story having to do with alleged wage theft. A few weeks ago, the Iowa Center for Worker Justice filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Labor. Now, this complaint alleges that a factory in Iowa City called Rock 10 has denied wages to at least a dozen of its temporary employees. Here to tell us about the complaint, Misty Rebick, Executive Director at the Center for Worker Justice of Eastern Iowa. Misty, welcome to our program.
Thanks.
Tell us more about this complaint you filed.
So we were approached by workers back in June who had been denied their paychecks after they'd worked a couple of weeks at the factory. And only after they approached our center and garnered support from community members and actually went to the factory to demand their wages did they get their pay. And these workers said, well, this is happening all the time to other workers, but everyone's afraid to come forward because they think they're going to get fired. So we asked them to reach out to their peers. And by August, we had a meeting with over a dozen workers who all were talking about problems of missing hours on their paychecks and also this other issue of being directed to come into work 30 to 45 minutes early every day in order to even be considered for work that day.
Mm. So you need to show up. They allege you need to they were told to show up 30 or 40 minutes beforehand and didn't even know they would get work that day.
That's right. So what we've been told over and over again by workers across race and ethnicity is that you need to be at work. So let's say your shift starts at 7. You got to be there by 6:30, sign your name on a piece of paper, and then wait to see if they call your name that day for work. So you're waiting sometimes 30 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever it may be. And you might get chosen, which is great. And then you get to clock in around 7 or 7:15, or you don't. You get sent home. So either way, you spent 45 minutes of your day without any pay at all. And the workers who are working are missing 45 minutes of pay.
Mm-hmm. So this is the missing wages, the wages that they're demanding.
This, and along with a consistent pattern of missing hours on their checks. So you might work, you know, Monday through Saturday, and your check next week won't have the Saturday on it. And you might go and speak to your supervisor about it, and they say, well, you have to prove that you're at work. So then even workers go as far as organizing the line and getting some of their coworkers who were there with them to go speak with the supervisor, yet the supervisor says that's not sufficient. So they just missed that Saturday's pay, even though they were there. So lots of workers report that happening still.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about these workers. Who are they?
Sure. So, you know, there are a variety of people. There's African-Americans, there's white people, there's African immigrants, there's Latino immigrants. It's really a hodgepodge of different folks from different walks of life who are just trying to get by. Many are very desperate to have a job because they're trying to put food on their food on the table for their families. Lots of them work two or three additional jobs beyond this because the wages are so low. It's only an $8 an hour factory job. No matter how long you've been there, that's the most you're going to get paid if you've been hired through a temp agency. Mm-hmm. And so these workers are, like I said, from all different walks of life. Many of the people in our complaints are African Americans who are, you know, working hard supporting their families. Some are Latinos and some are white.
And you give them assistance in filing this complaint?
So what we do here at the center is we believe in empowerment of people to take on different injustices in their community. So the first thing we do is we educate them about the rights that they have. We talk about the laws that are on the books. We examine what might be violating laws. And we also just examine what is an injustice. Just because it might not be illegal, it's still not fair. And then we look at different options that we have to try to resolve those issues together as an organized front of people. And so we did try to reach out to Rock Penn to get a negotiation meeting to discuss these problems before ever doing anything public. We really wanted to have a meeting where workers could talk with their bosses about these practices. Unfortunately, Rock 10 never got back to us, even after we reached out to our legislator, Senator Joe Volcom, who also spoke with the plant manager, and to no end. They basically refused to meet with us to talk about it. And that's what really encouraged us to move forward and file a complaint with the Federal Department of Labor.
I see that the Iowa City Press Citizen had a comment from the Rock 10 media spokesperson, Robin Keegan, quoted here, saying that the people involved in this complaint who worked at the Rock 10 factory were actually employees of a temporary staffing agency, CFA, mm-hmm. and Sedona.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard that as the reason this is happening?
Well, that's exactly what is going on, is we have a big, large corporation who contracts with these shady contractors, these shady temp staffing agencies that come, and they actually are housed inside the factory, and that's how they're hiring all their employees. And so, though, yes, these workers are actually working through these staffing agencies, they work in the Rock 10 premises, they work with Rock 10 products, they're directed and controlled by both the temp agency and supervisors who are hired by the Rock 10. And then Rock 10 is directly benefiting from their labor. And so in terms of looking at joint employment, we look at this situation as Rock 10 has a responsibility to be ensure that if they're going to contract out their workers, that those contractors are following the law. I mean, those contractors are even on the premises, they're on the property of Rock 10. You know, you have to go to the Rock 10 factory to get a job there through one of these temp agencies. So, but what we see across industries is, unfortunately, this is the future of work for workers if we don't stand up and organize. You know, in hotels, in restaurants even, in factories, we see the use of temp agencies. And temp agencies, frankly, are not just a cover-up for bad treatment of workers. And so we think is that Rock 10 has definitely has some responsibility in this.
Now, this complaint was filed a few weeks ago with the U.S. Department of Labor. I understand you spoke with the Department of Labor this past week about this case. What are the latest developments?
So the director of the Department of Labor, Mike Stabell, has assured us that they're looking into the case and that there's been an investigator assigned to the case. and they'll do what they normally do in an investigation. They'll contact the employers, and they'll start doing interviews with employees, and they'll review the payroll, and you know, they'll come to some sort of conclusion whether they're violating the law or not.
Mm-hmm. How prevalent is this type of, this is alleged wage theft, but how prevalent is this sort of thing?
I think it's really prevalent. I think wage theft is rampant across the country. It's rampant across Iowa, and it's really rampant here in Iowa City. The problem is that there's a lack of enforcement. So when we have our Iowa Workforce Development, who is responsible for making sure that Iowa employers comply with wage and hour law, and we only have one, maybe two investigators for the entire state for, like, what is that, 1.2 million workers, and they get over 100 complaints per month of wage theft. And those are just the people who are complaining. And so what we do know is that wage theft is happening so often, and what we think is because it's due to a lack of enforcement. There's not enough investigators. And when we do actually, and when our investigators actually do pursue a case, the worst thing that happens to an employer is that they just pay what they originally owed to begin with. There's no interest. There's no fine. There's no court record. And so really, if you're an employer here in the state of Iowa and you're thinking about suing from your employees, it's not a bad idea, because if you get caught, the only thing that's going to happen is you're going to pay them what you originally owed them.
Misty, you're on fire. You're passionate about this.
Yeah, I am. The thing is that it is really prevalent. And I can just say it over and over again. People don't have to believe me, but it's like we get calls every single day of people who are going through wage theft, you know. So it's something that we got to deal with as a state.
Misty Rebick, Executive Director at the Center for Worker Justice of Eastern Iowa. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. When do we get rid of the old to make way for the new? Well, that's a question facing the city of Iowa City. The Iowa City City Council has scheduled a special session that could determine the fate of three historic cottages currently facing demolition. The session will decide whether to hold a public meeting to determine whether the 150-year-old buildings will receive historic landmark status. Here to tell us about this story, Adam Burke, producer and writer in Iowa City, also writes for Little Village Magazine. Hello, Adam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit of background about these cottages, actually not too far from our Iowa City studio.
Mm-hmm. The lots were bought in 1854. We're not quite sure when they were built. If it was before the Civil War, that's a criteria for a historic designation with the National Landmark Registry. But we don't exactly know. We know they are 150 years old. They're some of the first buildings that had businesses owned by women. There was a poetry movement that started in 1970 in one of the cottages in a bookshop. They've been part of this neighborhood for as long as the railroad station has been there.
Mm-hmm. And what's there now?
There's three businesses. There's a bookshop, a gift shop, and a Kung Fu Studio Academy.
Mm. Okay. So tell us, the start of this controversy is in November. What happened then?
In November, a group came to the city and said they wanted to develop. They asked for rezoning from commercial to this new district called the Riverfront Crossings. And in doing that, there's some incentives. In the old zoning, they could put up a building that was 15 units, an apartment building. With the new designation, there's more. I'm not sure exactly mm-hmm. how
this
much.
This is a piece of property on the edge of campus, and mm-hmm. in this area you've seen high-rises spring up and mm-hmm. Also a lot of apartments for students at the University
mm-hmm.
of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. It's about 20 blocks in an area south of downtown.
Just a couple blocks south of downtown.
It has been slated for redevelopment, revitalization by the city planners. Just this summer, they passed a development plan.
Mm-hmm. Now, another group gets into this called the Friends of Historic Preservation. How did they enter the picture?
They saw the historic value, of course, and wanted to save the buildings. So at a meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission in November, they were at the meeting and said, we would like to have another inspection report The first inspection report found that the buildings were unsafe and unsound.
Mm-hmm. And that's a crucial factor.
Yes.
That would allow demolition. If it's unsafe, unsound, and unrepairable?
Right. And they crowdfunded a inspection report, raised over $2,000 in a weekend to have a new inspection. They went in on Monday after that meeting, did their inspection, which found that the buildings were reparable and mostly safe and sound.
We have a bit of intrigue, don't we? We have a disagreement between the inspection. So so what will happen going forward?
Well, we're waiting for the city to decide if there's even a public hearing to decide to pursue this landmark designation, historic landmark designation. Mm-hmm. Based on what some architectural historians have said, just if they were built before the Civil War, that's a criteria. Other criteria, that some of the earliest settlers in Iowa City may have lived there, that's enough to get it, landmark historic designation.
Now, is this part of a larger trend in Iowa City? Has this been happening in other parts of town?
Not with buildings this old, I don't think, but Iowa City has definitely seen an influx of first-level commercial, top three levels apartments, which is important for Iowa City because it's a problem finding rental property. We're one of the fullest counties in the state, the fullest county in the state. It's hard to find a place to live.
It raises a question. You know, we think about it when we're, at least I do, sorting out clothes in a closet. When do you keep the old to make way for the new? Mm-hmm. Do we have any guidelines, any way to judge that? Or how the city will approach it, I guess, is the big question.
Yeah. Now, in that Riverfront Crossings development plan, they targeted those three cottages and said, let's try to save them. And they put in an incentive to do that. Mm-hmm. So if those three were saved, they said, and it's based on this one property owner who owns almost that whole block on South Dubuque, 600 mm-hmm. South Dubuque, they said that a developer could have a higher density building. So instead of the four-story, which is code, which is the buildings you see all over town now, the new apartment with mixed use below, they could go eight stories or higher. Mm-hmm. So that's an incentive for them to save those cottages. They were trying to push through a demolition by saying they were unsound. Now that's on hold, of course. Mm-hmm.
Any sense of where the sympathies in the community lie? I suppose it's divided. You've got people who can understand both sides of this.
I think so. I know that the property owner is, he wants to sell the whole block and get out of the business. He's been very sick and just wants to end his ownership of that area. I know other people are saying, let's save these cottages. I can see both sides.
Okay, we'll find out the fate at some point. We don't know quite when. The fate of three cottages, historic cottages, 150-year-old buildings, it's thought, in Iowa City. Adam Burke, producer and writer in Iowa City, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we speak with the Iowa author of What Did Jesus Drive? Also, where did Giving Tuesday come from and why? Your news buzz continues after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we know automotive recalls are a part of our daily weekly news diet, at least. Well, this week, perhaps you're following this story. Federal regulators gave the automotive parts company Takata until next Tuesday to widen its recall of airbags to the entire United States. My next guest has spent his career as a corporate first responder of sorts to auto company PR disasters. Jason Vines is a native Iowan, grew up in Pella. He's a public relations professional and author of the new book, What Did Jesus Drive? Crisis PR in Cars, Computers, and Christianity. He will be in Iowa on December 10th and 11th, speaking at Central College in Pella and also Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. He joins us by phone. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for talking with us a few minutes. So tell us, you've been following the scene for many years. Has this been a bad year for auto safety recalls, or is this normal, what we're hearing?
Well, the numbers are huge, mainly because General Motors has recalled 26 million vehicles. But I take the tack that this is good news. It means they aren't hiding defects. They're making sure people know about them and get them into dealerships and get them fixed. Yes, the number's high, but I'd rather have it that way than hiding defects and people not knowing they're in something that could possibly kill them.
This is in your book, but tell us quickly the length and breadth of your experience here dealing with PR crises.
Well, I started at Chrysler in PR after becoming there as a labor economist out of Michigan State. And pretty soon I was in one crisis after another, a faulty transmission that nearly bankrupted Chrysler, sudden acceleration, the second major sudden acceleration supposed crisis involving Jeep vehicles. I then moved over into Nissan to take over North American PR operations, and the day I got there, they were basically bankrupt. But I had a hand, quite proudly, in bringing them back, their image back, and they're doing great today. Some credit me with being the father of the new Z, Nissan Z. I was convinced to join Ford Motor Company in February of 2000, and a week or two after I started, the fire started.
Oh, yes. Remember that one. Yeah, that was a big one, wasn't it? Perhaps the biggest.
It's still, hopefully it will always be considered the biggest crisis in the auto industry. I'd hate to have something worse than that. 271 people died. And of course, Ford and Firestone went at each other tooth and nail, although we didn't want to. We put the safety and satisfaction of our customers first and always above other factors such as legal implications or financial. The second wave of that tire crisis, Firestone refused to recall tires, and so we had to do it for our customers.
Mm-hmm. You've listed off a number of things. I'm sure you're involved in so many other things, and a lot of them captured in your new book, What Did Jesus Drive? But give us, boil it down to a few lessons that you could tell us, the takeaways from your career full of these sorts of crises and the management of them.
Well, the first guiding principle is a crisis is coming. It may be small, it may be big, but if you think you're immune to a crisis, you are missing the first guiding principle. That way, at the beginning, middle, or end of a crisis, you have to put your customer safety and satisfaction first and foremost, no matter what industry or organization you are. That's first and foremost. Second, you have to stick to the facts and tell the truth all the time. You can't guess. That'll hurt you. You can't lie. That'll kill you. And you have to communicate openly and honestly at all times.
We don't necessarily associate the things you just mentioned with corporate culture. Do you think corporate culture is changing in this way?
I think our culture in general is changing, unfortunately, negatively. Look at the IRS. They didn't tell the truth. Look at the NFL. Roger Goodell looks like he didn't tell the truth. BP blew it a few years ago with the oil rig disaster. And now we have Bill Cosby having a hard time with the truth. So it's just not an auto industry issue. In fact, I'd say the auto industry is one of the more noble endeavors out there and have been for decades. Sometimes some people screw up. For instance, today's news about Takata. They obviously hid something, and they're handling this poorly. But I got to say, there's one group that's handling it worse, and that's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, who is demanding a nationwide recall now. We know from the science that those people in humid areas are more susceptible to harm by these airbags. So yes, Takata should say, we'll do this nationwide, but not all at once. We're going to take care of the people in the South who are most in harm's way, and we'll get to the Paul, Minnesota. But if NHTSA prevails and Takata has to do nationwide all at once, some people in Phoenix or some people in Houston are going to have to wait longer in line because there's airbag modules going through Des Moines, Iowa, or Fargo, North Dakota. So this is craziness on the government's part because they are bowing down to the safety advocates and the plaintiff's attorneys.
What Did Jesus Drive, the title of your new book? Where do you get that title?
Twofold. about 10 or 12 years ago, there were a bunch of loons going out saying, under the guise of what would Jesus drive, saying if you drove an SUV, you were a sinner, or you were supporting terrorists. And it was leading an eco-terrorist group to go around the country and burn dealerships that had SUVs, putting our firefighters in harm's way. I fought against them by finding Jesus. His name was Jesus Rivera. He was a retiree who drove two SUVs. He was a Vietnam vet. And I took a picture of him, gave him $500, and put a full-page ad in USA Today which said, "What does Jesus drive?" We asked him. And we pointed out the hypocrisy of these groups, and it killed them. Secondly, after my career in the auto industry, I joined a fellow Nissan guy who had moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan to work for Zondervan, the world's largest Bible company. And he said, "We have to avoid a crisis in launching the Bible." I go, "What are you talking about?" They took the most popular Bible, the NIV, and retranslated it into more modern language, and the evangelicals went crazy and boycotted it. And it almost put the company out of business, but they needed to try to do it again and do it right. And they asked me to come on board and help navigate to avoid a crisis. It got so bad that before I arrived there, a Bible that had been retranslated was sent to the Zondervan headquarters with a bullet hole through it. There's some mean Christians out there, believe it or not. Well, we were successful in navigating, bringing our enemies closer because they were our customers. And we successfully relaunched the Bible and very proud of that.
Mm. Jason Vine, so many stories. Thanks for sharing a few of them with us. And you'll undoubtedly have many stories for those who see you next week in Iowa, December 10th and 11th at your alma mater, Central College in Pella, also Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. What Did Jesus Drive? Crisis PR in Cars, Computers, and Christianity, authored by Iowa native Jason Vines. Thanks for joining us for a few minutes, Jason.
Thanks so much. And the book is available in all forms on Amazon right now.
Quick conversations about news items we didn't get to earlier in the week. That's why we have News Buzz Friday. I'm Ben Kiefer on River to River. Well, in just two short years, Giving Tuesday, this past Tuesday this year, Giving Tuesday, the global day of giving on Tuesday after Thanksgiving, has evolved from an inspirational idea to a worldwide media and philanthropic phenomenon. Where did Giving Tuesday come from and why? Hopefully with the answers. Stacy Palmer is with us, the editor at the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Hello, Stacy.
Hi, happy to join you.
Tell us the story behind this new phenomenon, Giving Tuesday.
Giving Tuesday was the brainchild of a fundraiser who got frustrated seeing all the shopping going on. We have Cyber Monday and Black Friday, and thinking, why don't people think about charitable giving that way? And so he pushed the idea and said, why don't we just come up with something where we name a day soon after Thanksgiving and call it Giving Tuesday. And it started really small, but a lot of people love the idea. And the United Nations Foundation adopted the idea and started spreading it. And so a lot of powerful people started getting engaged in it. And by its third year, some people think that it really is a tradition that's going to have lasting legs and be something that we all think about just in the same way that we talk about Cyber Monday. I don't think we're all the way there yet, but we certainly saw amazing growth this year, probably 64% increase in donations between this year and last year.
Mm-hmm. Online in your journal, The Chronicle of Philanthropy, this is an opinion piece. I just wanted to excerpt a little quote from it and have you react to it because it is, you know, when something this nice kind of blooms as Giving Tuesday has. We want to be careful of some downsides. Here's a voice here, and I'm sorry I didn't note who had this opinion piece, but let me quote it. In these 2 years, Giving Tuesday is beginning to feel like Begging Tuesday, which risks alienating those we are trying to reach and potentially harming the entire nonprofit sector. Tell me about that worry.
Yes. And that was from a social service leader in Harlem who is, you know, a very good and strong fundraiser, but felt like all of this asking and asking for money is not necessarily appropriate, and that some people get put off by the idea of what they see as begging and charities asking for too much, and that that spirit of giving would be better to say, why don't nonprofits themselves give back? And so one of the things he had his group do was is, you know, they provided meals to the needy that day, extra ones. They got people involved in volunteering and really saw that as a giving back day rather than an asking for money day, which is just a super idea.
Mm-hmm. And in just a moment, we're going to be talking with a woman at United Way of Muscatine who is, in fact, doing what you just described. I wonder if, Stacy, you are located on the East Coast but very much in touch with giving in Iowa. Can you tell us about how we look here in Iowa in terms of giving, the differences between the areas, the counties, the regions?
One of the things that we did recently was a ranking of states and big cities and really getting down to the county level in charitable giving. And so you can go on our website and take a look and find your own zip code just to be able to look at what giving's like. Iowa ranked 26 in the states, and it was Sioux County that was the most generous of all the counties we looked at in Iowa. Average share of income that residents are giving is 2.89%, so really smack in the middle of what people are giving. And, you know, I'm sure what many of the nonprofits would like to do is have that go up and try to encourage people to think about trying to lift that level a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And on the website, if you search the state by metropolitan statistical area, a unit you use there, the Nebraska-Omaha area, as well as Sioux City in the western part of the state, seem to beat both Des Moines and Cedar Rapids for giving.
So, you know, there are lots of reasons why giving is different in various regions, and sometimes it just happens, you know, to be that there was a campaign that was encouraging people to give in a particular year. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that one group is way more generous than the other, mm-hmm. but nonetheless, we can start seeing some differences and maybe the power of the charities that they're doing a better job of raising money and encouraging people to give.
Stacy Palmer, editor at the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's keep on the topic of giving and charity. We said this past Tuesday was Giving Tuesday. Maybe you supported your favorite charities on that day. However, this year, the United Way of Muscatine took a different approach. Instead of asking people for donations of money, they asked people to donate their time. Nicole Sorgenfrey is with us, program director at the United Way of Muscatine. Hello, Nicole.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. What made your chapter of the what made your Muscatine, United Way, decide to ask for volunteers rather than money donations?
Well, we really strive on the give, advocate, volunteer method that United Way has inbred into us. So this year we took it full circle by giving opportunities in all three areas. We found donors to help with the cost of the event, and then we went out and found volunteers to help us pack food for the hungry in Muscatine.
Mm-hmm. So what was that event like? How many volunteers? What was happening?
We had a little over 20 volunteers, and we packed 2,000 meals, and it took about an hour and a half.
Mm. What was the atmosphere like? I bet you it was nice.
It was good. Everyone was very happy about it. It's a new program that we're introducing to Muscatine. We've partnered with Faith United Church in Muscatine, and they have bought the beginning cost equipment for the packing of the food and so forth. So
mm-hmm. Equipment, what would that be?
It is aprons, hair nets and gloves, and we have funnels. What we do is we pack macaroni and cheese with a soy base, so we have all the containers that hold the food for the packing and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Did you said 20 volunteers, more than you expected or planned on?
Well, we worked really hard to find those 20 volunteers, and it really wasn't hard to find volunteers for this kind of event. Sometimes when we go out and find volunteers for an event, it can be kind of hard, but this one, everybody was really willing to give back to the community.
Mm-hmm. So this is a good way, it seems, for those on tight budgets to support the causes they believe in. Did you find that to be the case, that people came in and said, you know, I'm short of money this year, but I'd sure like to help out?
And that's what we like. We like people to know that they can give in lots of different areas. They don't have to just give money. They can give their time, or they can be an advocate for United Way as well.
Mm-hmm. So do you expect this to be continuing next year?
And I think it'll be bigger next year as well.
Okay. Nicole Sorgenfrey, Program Director at the United Way of Muscatine. Continued good luck in your fundraising on into the new year.
Well, thank you so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me now, Jacqueline Hallbloom, Iowa Public Radio music host. She's host of the monthly Iowa Arts Showcase, joining us every month. Hello, Jacqueline.
Hey, Ben. How's it going?
It's going well. We want to remind our listeners you can tune into Iowa Public Radio on Saturday, December 6th, 11 in the morning, and at 5 p.m. for the December edition of the Iowa Arts Showcase. And I hear it's packed with a lot of holiday arts events. Let's talk about some of them, Jacqueline.
Bruce Moore is going all out. They have a professional florist come in who spends the whole day decorating this Victorian mansion. And Bruce Moore is a historic site, a National Historic Trust for Historic Preservation site in Cedar Rapids. And it's just an amazing Victorian home. And one of the things that's also really cool about this place is that they have this Skinner Player pipe organ, which they put in, one of the owners of the house, Irene Douglas, put in 1929. And it's pretty amazing that it has its own pipe organ. It has something like 715 pipes. And they're going to rev this thing up for the holidays. And so if you go through the house, you get to hear the organ at the same time.
A Skinner Player pipe organ. That's a type of pipe organ? See, I'm not acquainted with that.
Well, apparently Skinner is an organ builder, an American organ builder, and they had their heyday, actually, during the 20s and 30s, and some of the best organs. And a few people who had lots of money had them put in their own private homes. And this organ is unique because it is a player organ. There were like 92 of them originally made. There are only 6 left in existence. So this is a rare beast. And they're in a renovation right now to get the organ up to snuff. They just took these 400-pound blowers and hauled them out and revved them up and got them all back in shape. So I don't know how much dust is going to be coming out of these pipes, but you can hear this organ and also see this marvelous mansion, Bruce Moore Mansion in Cedar Rapids. It's really quite a wonderful thing, and I guess I have to say that Bruce Moore is pulling out all the stops for the holidays.
Okay. Another aspect you'll be touching on in this month's edition of the Iowa Arts Showcase is the fact that an Iowan, a Cedar Falls artist and illustrator, is the author of a children's book that has found its way to the New York Times Best Children Books of the Year.
Pretty amazing stuff. And Gary Kelly is humbled by this honor, but when you take a look at this book, Harlem Hellfighters, which is a picture book, which he wrote with or he illustrated with J. Patrick Lewis, it's just a marvelous, marvelous book. And it's about the Harlem Hellfighters. If you don't know anything about this group of 2,000 all-black men, they were from the 369th Infantry for World War I. And he traces these men being recruited by none other than a jazz musician who had a band, and they all go over to France and fight in World War I valiantly, receive medals. And it also gets into some other issues, the issues of the Jim Crow laws, the racism. And so they're kind of juxtaposed side by side, these men that are fighting for America and at the same time are struggling for some real issues in America.
And finally, before we go, Jacqueline, I want to ask you about something that's happening in the central part of the state, the western part of the state. We've been in eastern Iowa, I think, for up to now. But Iowa State University is presenting a performance of a chestnut. No, it's the Nutcracker Ballet.
And they've been doing this for 34 years. This is a tradition, and they have like 200 local dancers in this from all across central Iowa. And just organizing this and all those tutus just blows my mind. But it's a marvelous tradition that they have going. And, of course, the music of Tchaikovsky, it doesn't get much better than that. Yeah. So they are bringing in a guest, Sugar Plum, who is an Ames native, which is very special, as well as a Cavalier. So they have two professional dancers as well as some excellent, very fine dancers from the Ames and Central Iowa area. And just a marvelous opportunity to see this holiday classic.
Oh, yes. And I think we're going to leave with a little bit of the overture from the Nutcracker. Jacqueline Hallbloom, host of Iowa Arts Showcase and Iowa Public Radio music host, thank you for keeping us abreast of what's going on in the arts across Iowa. Tune in to the Iowa Arts Showcase for December on December 6th, this coming Saturday, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. again. Thank you, Jacqueline.
Well, thank you, Ben, and we want to wish everybody a happy holidays.
And same to you, Jacqueline Hallbloom. And that does it for this edition of River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.